Okay. excuse me. Public forum. I recognize, by the way, that there was a noticing issue of an address of where this lovely facility is, and so people were going around in circles this morning, including myself. And as a result, I have three public forum cards, and if there is anybody that comes in late, we will accommodate that as well. So looking at public forum then, in the order that I have these cards stacked right now, Bob Marino and Cindy Wilcox?
Yes.
Please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, board members, staff, and public. My name is Bob Marino. I'm the general manager of DG Fairhaven Power. We're located just west of Eureka on the coast. It's nice to be up here in Willow Creek. I don't get up here as often as I used to. With me today is Cindy Wilcox, a certified professional soil scientist on staff at SHN Consulting Engineers. Cindy helped develop our fly ash program and has administered it since 1996. I think you'll find Cindy's brief presentation very informative. Thank you. Cindy Wilcox.
Do you want to do the buttons? Or do you want to do the So, as Bob introduced me, I'm Cindy Wilcox, and I'm certified as a soil scientist, and I've administered with the fly ash for many years. What is in the fly ash, the type of material that's used to produce power with DG Fairhaven, is sawmill residuals, mainly chips and particles that are left over from producing lumber, and also 25% are whole logs and branches and bark that are brought out from the forest. And what is in, after incineration, what is in the material is, these are heavy metals that we monitor through the program. And just want to point out, this is in milligrams per kilograms. That's roughly parts per million. This is a log scale. The green is DG Fairhaven's. We've been monitoring since 1994, the metals. And the red is the September 2010 California Human Health Screening Levels, and we call them chisels. And these are the 2010 rates, and you can see that DG Fairhaven is well below the rates that are determined by the chisels. And almost a third to half of our metals are even non-detect. We put down the range right here. They're non-detect. And even though I put it in the range, so it's either in 0.2 or even below, we're not sure, but I put the highest range that we could put for all the metals that we have representing our the DG Fairhaven ash. Two of these metals I want to pull out differently. In 1994, we have 130 parts per million, roughly milligrams per kilograms, and still under the 2005 chisels. But 1995 to present, the lead are 3.3 to 22, still under the 2010 residential chisels. Arsenic, we have up to a year and a half ago when the 2010 came in, we were under the guidelines of 500 parts per million, milligrams per kilograms. In 2010, they changed down to 0.7. When I talked to DTSC, the Department of Toxic Substance Control, I said, you know, how do we deal with such low levels? She said, Dr. Klein told me I really have to be able to work with the background levels of arsenic, because in California, arsenic levels are native in our soils. And so here are background soils from the Humboldt area where we use the ash. And we're well within, DG Fairhaven's well within the background levels, 3.6 to 7.4, and DG Fairhaven's 2.2 to 5, well within or below the background levels that we have in our existing native soils. And dioxin TEQ levels, as an example, here's the commercial levels allowed by the chisels, and here's residential at 4.6 to the negative 6. So 4.6 to the negative 6 milligrams per kilogram is roughly parts per trillion. So this is a very small amount. And DG Fairhaven was sampled in 1991. It's below today's level of residential screening levels. And 2010 is even farther down, and there's 2011, our most recent sample. So as you can tell, our dioxin TEQ levels are extremely low. So this is where, what do we do with the ash once it's been incinerated? This is where SHN steps in, and we identify eligible sites for application. There's two ways we put it, as a soil amendment and also as a loafing bed. For the soil amendment, we obtain sites, and then we have signed contracts. We test the soils for appropriate nutrient levels and also for background metal, make sure that the we don't over-apply with metal, so we keep track of that, and we've never had any issues with that. And we apply during the weather conditions allowing, you know, between rain and however we can get out to be able to follow these 50-foot buffers, 100-foot buffers, and we maintain every records of everywhere we place the ash. And here's an example of a pre-application site. Here's a windrow where the ash has been put down by the truck. We have a pre-site buffer boundary, show them where the 50 feet is so that they don't apply and isn't tilled in within our between the 50-foot, between the drainage and the field. And this is what it looks like after we've tilled it in. Our second, and this is also, we do superficial apply application with a spreader, and this is 8 months after we apply it. And here is a field. This is an out of the application area. We applied, this is 2009, and we applied it in the winter of 2010 during our nice January weather. And this is the following year later. You can see how it's greened up just in a year. Much higher yield, and the farmers were much happier that they would be able to have a much higher yield rate on a pasture that was in really poor condition. So this is what ash can do to our fields. And also the fly ash we use it as a loafing bed, and this is something that, what is a loafing bed? It's usually a pile that we create, and it's for cows to get out of the mud area. Usually it's a high traffic area where usually they'd be standing in the mud after they've been milked or had their food. And it's something that the Dr. Roland Myers from the regional board has encouraged and guided me. There's one of the papers that you have with our with the material I gave you shows the beneficial use of having high pH keeps the bacterial count down and helps keep the health of the cows. And so we identify the sites. I obtain a BMP contract, which again was we've been submitted through the regional board. We use our buffer, and then we make sure that we cap with sand, wood chips, soil, or a thick layer of hay, and we have keep records of where we place it and the volume. And here's an example of the loafing bed. I know last month you saw pictures of large piles of ash in this area, and this is what, after we finish with it, we pile it up, and we mound it. We cover it with, in this case, redwood bark. Here's another example of hay bales and seeding. So here's the beginning of the seeding, and then here's 9 months later. It shows that hay right here is breaking down and becoming part of the landscape, and something that keeps the cows out of the mud and in much better health. So, any questions?
My understanding, by the way, is we heard about this, or this was tangentially related to the Scotia, and then it actually came over as Bob's aware, it came out as well in the last meeting, just about Fairhaven as well, about how ash is generally being handled, and then it was related to dioxins and metals. So This information is informative, and I know that we had given staff direction to come back to us. Thank you for putting this in the record as informative information of what you guys are doing. I know that our staff is working forward in gathering information about how to kind of holistically handle ash, not only for Fairhaven, but other applicable facilities. Any board member questions?
Yes.
Mr. Corbett.
I think this microphone's working, that I'm close enough to it. It's. I just wanted to ask you, there was a dramatic drop in the dioxin from 1991, 2010, 2011. what caused that drop, or is that within the plus or minus variability of the measurements? I mean, it's a very dramatic decline in dioxin levels, which is a great thing, but I'm
yes.
trying to figure out what happened. How did that occur?
The big drop, as you can see, is from 1991 to 2010.
Yes.
Fuel supplies do change.
Yeah.
And my fuel supplies have been very static lately. Long-term contracts with people that I know and trust, companies that I've worked with for a long time. It all starts with the fuel supply, John.
Right. Okay, so could I imply in that you're getting a little less hardwood than softwoods in the current mix?
No,
because I know on the air side, the hardwoods were the ones that had the trace contaminants when the pulp mill was trying to treat them.
If I had my druthers, I would burn hardwood all the time.
Okay. So for you, the hardwood is actually better?
Yes.
Okay.
I utilize about 25% of my annual feedstock comes from tan oak logs that I've purchased during logging season, which I'm currently doing. I think last year I bought about 60,000 tons of non-burnishable tan oak logs. I let them dry out during the summer months, and I utilize them as a dry source of fuel during the winter months. It also represents a surety of supply. If one of my suppliers should have some downtime, it's not going to hurt me. But more importantly, it's moisture content in the feedstock. The lower... let me put it this way. The higher the moisture content, the more challenging meeting CO limits may be, as you know.
All right. Thank you.
Any other board member questions? All right. I expect that this is a process of discovery for us and for, I believe, the community, the regulated community out here. Mm-hmm. So we do appreciate this information. It's entered into the record, and I expect in the next few months we'll kind of start to get this more formulated.
I appreciate the opportunity to come before you again and to perhaps further educate everybody in attendance as to what the beneficial uses of the fly ash can be.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you both. I have a speaker card for Cindy Day Wilson. Who gave it, Susan? Okay, I don't have a whole lot of room up here, so I'll put that right there. Thank you. Yeah, just put it behind. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Cindy Day Wilson. I'm the city attorney for the city of Eureka. My purpose in being here is twofold. One, to introduce myself. I'm new to the area. I moved here from San Diego and took over the city attorney position in November of 2011. So I thought it was time I introduce myself to you all. The second purpose is coming to talk to you about a dry cleaning site that is in the city of Eureka known as Norman's Dry Cleaners. It's located on E and Grotto Street, in a business district known as Henderson Center in Eureka. How familiar you are with Eureka and Henderson Center. I'm here today to talk to you all and ask that you take a hard look at the remedial action plan that is being proposed for this site. There's been a draft RAP proposed by the basically the plaintiffs. This case is in litigation.
Mr. Chair? I'm sorry, this is Samantha Olson, your counsel. Can we clarify what site we're talking about? Because I think this might be a pending petition, in which case it would be inappropriate to talk about the substance of the underlying issue that's under a petition without all parties being noticed.
Do you maybe have an address just to clarify? Are we talking about a facility that's in process?
We are talking about Norman's Dry Cleaners on the corner of E and Grotto.
Yes, otherwise known as KFD Enterprises, mm-hmm. for the responsible party, that's mm-hmm. the one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sorry, unless your presentation is very general in nature, I think we ought to save this and have it re-noticed so that all the parties who might want to comment on it could.
It is general in nature. like I said, I have two purposes in being here. One is to introduce myself, and number two is just to raise the city's concern generally. I'm not going to talk specifics. I'm not going to talk data. I'm not prepared to do that today, but I am going to talk about the concerns the city has about generally just about the draft RAP that's being proposed. I wanted to bring it to the board's attention. We have been dealing with staff, but I thought it was important that we express our concerns publicly.
All right, I'll tell you what. Why don't we do this? Why don't you proceed, try to stay general, and if we start wandering in the weeds, I'm sure that we will hear about that.
That's fine.
Okay, stay general, please.
Okay, I will. As I said, there's a draft RAP that's been proposed before you all. The city has some, and again, I'm not going to talk data, but they have some very big concerns. What's being proposed, as I understand it, is a range of $100,000 to $11 million. The range that's from $6 to $11 million involves digging up city streets in the Henderson Center Business District, which obviously is a great concern to the city of Eureka. The depth that's being proposed is 11 feet. That will disrupt the business community greatly, not to mention that there are this is also in a residential area. So the city has great concerns about what is being proposed and how it will be done. We're also concerned that there's been no discussion in the draft RAP about how the excavation and tons of trucks coming through our community will impact the community. So from that standpoint, I wanted to bring that all to your attention.
Thank you for that. Have you commented, just not to get too deep here, but have you commented as an interested party to the remedial action plan process?
Yes, we have been very involved in the remedial action plan
process. Can I ask too, is the city named as a responsible party because of city sewers? And
the city is not named as a responsible party, has never been named. So we are simply a defendant in the litigation.
Okay.
So, and like I said, my purpose in being here is just to ask that there be a really hard look at this. We have businesses that will be greatly impacted, not to mention the city taxpayers who are being asked to put up a great deal of money on a site that admittedly has an owner that admitted they dump PCE into the city sewer system. So. Again, I'll scratch some of this because I'm trying to stay general. But basically, my plea is to ask the board to really take a hard look at the plan that's been proposed. The city continues to be available and is willing to work with the board and the staff and talk about this plan further.
Okay. Thank you for bringing that to our attention.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
I had two comments. One, I want to thank you for introducing yourself. I appreciate that. I had one question to counsel, Samantha Olson, and that's essentially, since this is in litigation, if the board wants to take a look at this, would the preferred mechanism be an informational hearing or appropriate litigation discussion?
Yeah, I'll admit that I'm not very familiar with the details because I was set aside as advisory staff pursuant to the petition that's been pending before the board, and it really seems to have been stayed for several years because of litigation. Mm-hmm. What I would propose is that come back to you next month after we do an investigation into the exact status and the procedural history of this and come back with a recommendation. I just don't have enough data.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's an appropriate response.
So, thank you. And I'd be willing to come back, or any city staff would be willing to come back and testify and provide you more. Yeah. I do have a card. I'll bring those out.
And I must say, if this doesn't ruralize you from San Diego, I don't know what could.
You know, I was going to ask you. I came totally, as you can tell, really not dressed for this.
So your heels were a little short.
Yeah. I actually had to go barefoot out there. So maybe on the notice next time you can say no heels over an inch or something. Anyway, it's nice to meet you all, and thank you.
Yes, thank you for coming. I appreciate it. All right, I have a speaker card for Deborah Bruce Hosser.
She wanted to go. I requested to come after Curtis. Is that possible?
You know, it says that up in the corner, too. All right, let me reshuffle the deck. Actually, I do not have a speaker card for Curtis, do I?
Mr. Chair, Curtis had contacted us ahead of time, so we had accommodated his request. For the record, why don't you fill out a card, but you don't have to do it right now.
No, apologize. Come on up, Curtis.
Yes. Here.
To the microphone, please.
So you want me to speak?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Please introduce yourself.
Curtis Miller. I'm an environmental planner for the tribal EPA in Hoopa. And my talk is relative to source drinking water of the Trinity River, since the tribe has a drinking water intake in the Trinity now.
Can you find your presentation for this?
Yeah. Wow. Let's just go ahead. I don't know if you have the handouts for that. Yeah, it looks long, but I'm going to zip through it.
I apologize, Curtis, to act like I don't know that you're supposed to come up here. I just didn't have a card, so
yeah.
Just a little bit of process.
Yeah, that's it. Swap. All right, my name again, Curtis Miller. This project started in 2006 as an expansion of our EPA program. The tribe has Clean Water Act authority. And let me just move on here. 2003, we went from shutting down our old dilapidated systems in Mill Creek and Campbell Creek to putting a rainy well and an intake in the Trinity River. And all of our drinking water and irrigation water now comes from the river. We do have some backups, but primarily all of our water comes from the Trinity River. This is the original assessment area. As of 2009, it goes from the South Fork confluence up to the drinking water intake in Hoopa. Does this thing have a little button on there? Some kind. Which color do you pass there?
Oh, you're trying to do that.
Yeah. Oh. Oops. Wrong button. Guess this isn't going as fast as I thought it would be. Oh, okay. Oh, that's where it was. Thank you.
Well, work for me. Here, play around with it.
Sure. All right.
Patty?
Well, never mind.
Oh,
there we go. Remotes. They're very good with remotes. Did you do function F9?
Sometimes after you turn it off, you have to give it a second. It'll put a fan on or something.
How about function F8? All right, moving forward. All right, this assessment area is about 150 square miles. Major sources that we're looking at, you know, serious major sources such as non-point source runoff from the roads, various contaminants that might go in there, septic systems, of course, algae, illegal dumps, give you all kinds of a cocktail of things that you're not sure what you're going to get. And recently, in the last couple of years, I assume a lot of people have already heard about this, the pot gardens. It's just an example of the things that are in the watershed. You get an oil spill from time to time, some bad logging roads, good logging roads. Bigfoot subdivision provides a lot of urban runoff directly into the Trinity. It's a lot of pavement. Mercer Fraser gravel right out here in Willow Creek. The concerns that we have for gravel, we also have one in Hoopa, is the disruption of potential of mercury sources from the old gold mining days that might be embedded in the gravel. The drinking water intake has a manifold that is actually embedded in bedrock and covered with only about 30 foot of gravel. And so mercury possibly flowing, sinking down, could infuse itself into our system. Landslides, this one's in Campbell Creek that flows off Forest Service land into Hoopa. It's a pretty massive landslide. Deep rotational slide has two sides of the creek. And it's been doing this into the Trinity about 3 miles up from the drinking water intake since about 2001. So it continues to do this even into this year. Septic systems. You can see there's a lot of septic systems in the lower Trinity. And this is the primary wastewater treatment source in the throughout the Trinity watershed. I'm not aware of any centralized wastewater treatment going into the Trinity. And what I do is I use GIS to plot these systems by having a standard of looking at buildings, trying to identify whether there's an outbuilding or a barn or a trailer, and using my best judgment to plot points, identifying where dwellings are and assuming there's a septic system there. There is some development, you know, most of the development's along the flats and within the river corridor, some right off, of course, right along the banks. So what we did is we took on a sampling of the seeps along there to see what the fecal coliform levels were like coming into the river. Last year was the first year sampling under a quality assured plan with the EPA region in San Francisco. It's about how many systems are within certain buffer zones, certain distance. See, about half is within a quarter mile of the river. And the closer you get to the river, the more porous it tends to get and less soil you have. We sample two samples per site. This is basically what we do. We go around sampling the seeps in the late summer when most of them are exposed and we can get to them. I plot them into GIS with a photo, and we have data that goes with it as well. Our lab is not a certified lab, but we use a certified technique, which is the CoalAlert 18 method, which is... been added to standard methods. So the EPA approved it because it really has to do with assessment. It's not necessarily making direct determinations. This is kind of the data that we're getting, and I'm comparing to information I get out of the regional board plan, which says 238 per 100 ml or 50 over 30 days in average, and that you have... If we had one source, in other words, that came out this high, we would have to notify the county, and the county would have to put out a public health alert. But as you can see, we don't have anything close to that. This one's actually, a site is Campbell Creek in Hoopa, that same creek that was purging out, and I think we got some squatters up there or something going there in the summertime. The river itself, when we test, I think this is site 21, really low. So we actually test the river coming in, which is looking really good. Illegal dumps. This was a dump that was in Campbell Creek, and we cleaned it up in 2005, I believe, gated off the road, and it's been pretty effective in protecting the water quality. Marijuana growing. This is the new baby here. I get some of these numbers from the sheriff and the drug task force. The amount of the numbers of plants, the numbers of gardens, And I just started doing some math on that. And this 30 gallons a day may be very conservative from what I'm hearing. In 90 days, it may be more like 4 or 5 gallons a day up to 120 days. So this is a pretty conservative estimate, and 200 plantations a year is fairly conservative as well. So you're looking at an equivalent of about 64 between the water combined with the fertilizer. You're looking at about 64 million gallons of somewhat like wastewater, highly concentrated slurry of things going into the mountains every year. As a matter of comparison, I think the city of Arcata is about 5 million gallons a day. Maybe it's gone up since then, since I was involved. This is a result. This was in 2009. We had some serious algae blooms in Hoopa, and this is in the valley. This was just out here by Clover Flat in 2009. And last year, which was a good water year, this is exactly the same. This has been 10 feet of this slide here. I mean, you see a marked difference in that. And part of it's enforcement. Part of it was a really good water year. So there's a lot of factors that affect algae that, you know, the only thing I'm saying is that nothing's changed much in the Trinity River except the large amount of marijuana growing. There hasn't been a lot of development. There's a lot of industry. Logging has been reduced quite a bit. There sure isn't a lot of grazing. So the one factor that did change was that. This was a good water year. Like I say, 2009 was the lowest water year we had in 10 years. So that does have an effect. This is what the Trinity Reservoir looked like that year. I hadn't gotten up there to actually see why it was green, but it's not blue. I mean, it is green. And I'd like to get up there this year, see what kind of algae might have been coming out of there. Lower downstream of that is the Lewiston Reservoir, and you can see there is a big algae bloom in there. And it's pretty good size, considering the size of the reservoir. It's kind of a close-up. I use aerial photos, recent aerial photos, to do a lot of the survey work. Of course, I couldn't cover a lot of this in the time span I have. So factors affecting it, such as clarity, temperature, and nutrients, primarily phosphorus, is usually your critical, your limiting nutrient, and that's a primary component of fertilizer for pot gardens. Soil tends to take up phosphorus right away. Farmers will sometimes, or cattlemen will sometimes, fertilize with sulfur to bring out the phosphorus, but that kind of nutrient management isn't really going on with pot gardens. The record of decision and how much flow we're getting has changed. Since 2005, they've increased the flows and to where we have longer flows earlier in the spring into the summer to keep the water cooler. This year, we peaked at about 6,000 CFS in May 10th. Here's a comparison of the river flows. And in 2009, we had a lot of algae peaked, and then last year, 2011, as well as temperatures. And you see there's marked difference in the amount of water coming through Hoopa, and then the temperatures are much higher. It was 2009 versus 2011. So there's other factors that are affecting the algae, but again, a limiting factor of having nutrients in there is also critical. Minor sources such as recreation and grazing for some of these concerns that were raised by the Hoopa community. I think they're pretty minor sources. Grazing, there's really not a lot of grazing. This is on the South Fork. There's good vegetated buffers out there. Minor or major, it depends on time of year or what else is going on out there. Agriculture and pesticides is a big concern for the Hoopa people. They generally have been traditionally drink out of springs and creeks. So drinking out of the river was a big move culturally for the tribe. And so I get a lot of concerns about what's going on in pesticides, and of course that goes to agriculture. I've highlighted 1 and 2 because that's Sun Valley Bulb Farms, which is a primary use of pesticides for all the agricultural interests. Newcomb Family Farm, they're organic. Some wine grapes out there. Trinity River Farms, very well managed. Not organic. He does use, you know, Miracle-Gro and things. but very well-managed property. Willow Creek Farms, I believe, is also organic. Bigfoot Golf Course, of course, is zoned agriculture, like all golf courses in Europe, zoned agriculture, not organic, and they use algicide. Likewise, I use GIS to plot these location and kind of the composition, the size, and what kind of contaminants may be coming out in general for each plot, Willow Creek as well. Sun Valley in 2006, and we went up there, they were kind of expanding their operation. This is the place where it's, you can see it right next to the river. It was important to note that when we went up there, the workers that were in there all put masks over their face and jumped in a van and took off up the hill. So the people that are applying the pesticides and working out there may not necessarily be even citizens and have any consciousness of what they're doing. So that is a concern. And who's responsible for these chemicals? Fertilizer and things like that. Luckily, where the runoff comes off from this particular plot goes into a porous vegetated area, and I think I've traced where it comes out to into the river, and it looks like it's not having much of an impact because where it comes out in there, there's polywogs, there's frogs, there's a lot of wildlife tracks, and if there was something really toxic coming in there, you might not see so much wildlife use, especially sensitive critters like frogs. Here's an example of, this was as of 2009, it just got updated, the 2010 just got updated, but on the California website, you can't really find out who's using what. I have to go to the county for that, and I'm going to be doing that this year. This is out of the material safety data sheets, unfortunately, and can't read it very well. But things like toxic to bees, toxic to invertebrates, daphnia, things that feed fish. We have some stuff down here that's hazardous to humans and animals if you get it on your skin. So in terms of drinking water, you know, the chemicals in here are, there's a lot of variabilities in the chemicals. The reactive agents, the actual agents that are doing the work, so to speak, are intellectual property for the company, so they're not listed in the material data safe, the MSDS sheets. So you don't even know what chemical is actually doing the work. A lot of times you'll have this stuff that's added to it. So between reactive chemistry, things like pH, soil interactions, water, interactions with water, these things can change. So what to test for and what we might actually be getting into our drinking water system is really a big question mark. I think in the analytical industry of pesticide runoff coming into the river and what is it turning into. So we're going to be looking at testing specifically for things that we can see in the MSDS sheets, but it may not cover everything. In 2011, this was an expanded area of the assessment area from the confluence of South Fork down to Higham Palm and confluence to Burnt Ranch. And South Fork is a pretty rural, mostly Forest Service land, not a lot of people living out there. As you can see, there's some, you know, homesteads and plots and concentrations. The main stem of Trinity is likewise, but you can't really see a lot of the development from the road. What you have to do is use a aerial photo to see it. And so here's a concentration, very highly concentrated residentials along the river. We haven't identified any seeps in here to sample. This is where I would come through in a raft and look for seeps. There's not a lot of public access through here. We'd have to go way up to Hawkins Bar to get in, and then this part of the river has a lot of white water in it. So, you know, I think this year we're going to just test the river here as it comes in. And if we start getting some high levels of fecals, then we might have to go in here and look for something that might be, you know, like in this area that might be putting a lot of fecals into the groundwater. But if we don't get a lot in here, if we don't get high levels, then, you know, it's working. Septic's working, dilution's working. This is a breakdown of the number of septic systems, like I just showed you in the main stem, and you can see, a lot of most of it's within a quarter mile of the river. Landslides. Landslides are a big problem. We had these two big landslides here, especially this one's a big problem. This one here is kind of healing, but you can imagine a couple inches of rain is really going to put a lot of material into the river. This one really gave way last July when we had about an inch of rain in the middle of the summer. And I was able to get up there and walk around. It's all on Forest Service land, and it's about 35 to 40 acres in size. Very active, and just going to be putting out dirt for many years, and it's going to be hard to stabilize it right away. This is what it did to the river, basically turned it into milk. This turbidity made it to Hoopa, which is about 20 miles downriver. Turbidity in Hoopa was about 30 NTUs, so it went from about 600 NTUs to 30 by the time it got in there. The resiliency of our drinking water plant is pretty good. The intake, the raw water intake was down to 1 NTU when the river was 30, and we have a pretty sophisticated treatment system. Most of it's Hawk. A lot of people might be familiar with that company, Hawk Instruments. It back flushes regularly based on flow. So algae, things like that, we can flush that out. The thing about algae is it does plug up our analyzers, so it does cause some problems with sensors. So susceptibility analysis, I use kind of a qualitative, quantitative thought process of things. For example, is there a direct pathway in connectivity to the river, such as logging roads, and that would be a highly susceptible source. The river would be highly susceptible to that source. This is an example of the susceptibility determination based on these type of potential contaminants. Of course, forest roads are connected, algae and sediments susceptible, gravel mining to some degree. It's a lot of protection measures in there. So these values are, you know, landslides, of course, marijuana plantations, you have no control over it, so that's a 10. River seeps and septics, they go right in directly. I'm using GIS to make more of an objective determination with some statistics to basically validate some of these numbers.
Hey, Curtis,
yeah.
Back up for a minute, would you
sure.
please? So your scale is 1 to 10, 10 being 1
to
the
10,
highest threat.
Yeah, sorry
in
about
your,
that.
Okay, it's all right.
And so plans for this year, and what I'm doing is coordinating meetings with stakeholders in the watershed like this one here. And basically to come up with a plan that's more specific, the base tier end of the basin regional plan, but also incorporate what the Forest Service is doing and any local ordinances that are going on, and basically bring those to light as kind of trying to meet the needs of the basin plan for meeting the needs of water quality in the Trinity. Of course, you know, tribe doesn't have an authority here, so we're just looking at this is something to kind of bring to light a little more attention, because drinking water is like the highest priority for and especially for something like a river, which
sure.
has a lot of use to it. So I'm pretty confident of the Trinity. If it wasn't for the landslides, it'd be a really pretty clean river for the most part. The up and down impacts based on water year and the amount of marijuana growing that's going on illegally and even legally, it's the lack of environmental consciousness of the people doing it. That's the big question mark. And a lot of the herbicides and pesticides that are being used, we're hearing about stuff that they're bringing in from Mexico that's basically eats your skin and kills everything. So, you know, these things, eventually, they're going to get into the watershed. And, you know, recreationalists, they get something on your skin, all of a sudden, you know, where did that come from? So here's a list of the stakeholders, including Water Quality Control Board. I have had met already with the Forest Service. I have a copy of my results from the up to last year. I met with the Agriculture, County Health. Haven't really met with the Planning Department. They're kind of in limbo, I guess, or having some reorganization. Sheriff's Department, I'm on conversations with them about, you know, the amount of growing going on, and I report to them, you know, things that we might see. We just had some people come through the valley in vans and their head right up the hill into the outback just last week. So we've got you know, we've got our, we have a bunch of gardens on the reservation we have to clean up that weren't local people. Willow Creek Community Services, of course, and public utilities. And these are what we would call, you know, part of our public distribution of findings, or anybody who gets a copy of our, of the report, including the local public, and primarily HOOPA. And here's an example of the fact that we're not the only ones using the Trinity for drinking water or for a water source. So throughout our assessment area, you see a lot of these intakes in the river that people are using as well. So it really is, it's helping other people as well. It's going to help protect recreation and the direct contact, but really paying more attention to the, you know, high level of quality of the water as a drinking water source is imperative here for the tribe. So any questions?
Well, first off, thank you. Curtis, how long has the tribe been collecting this data for?
I started this on the Trinity in 2006. In 2011, I expanded into the South Fork and up to the main stem up to Burnt Ranch.
And what's your mechanism for reporting this data or getting it out?
Right now, I have newspaper. I have a final report, which I could send copies to anybody who wants one. I do presentations at the EPA conference, tribal EPA conference every year. It's kind of a requirement of the grant program that I'm under as the source drinking water protection. And so, what, you know, they give you money to do this. They want to see what you've done. And custom presentations coming into, like I say, the county health department. I came in and did one for them. Presentations at the in HOOPA, public presentations.
And that reporting, excuse me, is an annual reporting mechanism. How do you do that? Because you're collecting data through seasons, I assume, and you're starting to build a data set that then at least gives a broader picture. You're expanding your net, not mm-hmm. only in watershed width and depth, but also your analytes or your constituents of concern here.
Mm-hmm.
Are you reporting that out on an annual basis? How are you doing that?
Yeah, in a final report annually.
Okay.
And as a requirement, I give that to my grant officer at the EPA office, Region 9 office in San Francisco, and it's a list of stakeholders I'm planning and already have been giving people copies from last year's report. So I'm kind of in the process of this year where I'm trying to put things, for example, county ordinances that are more specific about septic tanks, septic systems and management of that, Forest Service restoration plans. And I'm just kind of starting to go through a lot of these things to distill them down to what we would call a source water protection plan for drinking water.
Well, and you're actually out there on the front, it seems to me, of doing not only the data collection, but also providing information that becomes an educational component about, you know, cumulative effects or individual mm-hmm. effects. It seems to me, as you went through the list of kind of your source analysis here, that you've got the anthropogenics, like your septics, nutrients, and toxics, and then you have some kind of natural land sites.
Mm-hmm.
Those are big land sites. I
yeah.
saw actually one of those last night. That thing is a whopper, no doubt. As that data comes available, though, I assume you give that to our staff mm-hmm. on an annual basis. And as you do that, I would just request that be disseminated to us if you could. It's quite interesting. And by the way, the issue of the illicit marijuana growing out here, we have heard a lot about that.
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be hard for communities like this because it is out there in a huge way, and that is a huge challenge. We are certainly trying to wrap our heads around what we could do with that. There's a certain component of it that is the legal aspect of marijuana, and then there is, well, quasi-legal maybe, but there's an aspect of it that at least has got some framework, and then there's kind of everything else, which is out there for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah, and I think David Leland is my contact that I had arranged him to be a contact to send him copies of my report. And so if he's here or you know,
yeah, he's
I will be sending him a copy of my report as well.
No, and I appreciate that. I mean, and you're right, I think, in looking at the water intake, the drinking water aspect of it, drinking water tends to be the highest and most sensitive beneficial use. So you're talking about, you know, not only the anthropogenics, but some of the others that are out there as far as chemical constituents concerned, which could definitely affect not only your potability but your long-term viability, your source here, and you're on the downstream end of the whole Trinity River system.
Yeah.
So you're there.
But we have our own issues too. That we're definitely like the illegal dumps. We probably have more illegal dumps per square mile than most anybody. But we've cleaned a lot of them up.
Well, and recognizing too, you know, there is footprints out there, and they are maybe proportional, maybe not, to land base, but they are cumulative in watersheds. And, you know, to recognize that HOOPA, perhaps that's what I hear you say, mm-hmm. is that the HOOPA has a piece and a footprint of all your own and taking care of your own issues as well.
Mm-hmm.
Any other board member questions?
Mr. Corbin. Well, first I want to make some comments. I wanted to indicate your Clean Water Act certification to be treated as a state is accepted and respected. I also wanted to thank you for a government-to-government informational presentation. And I did want to say that this board will take seriously the provisions of the Clean Water Act on state-to-state responsibilities on meeting water quality standards. In regard to the MOUs, I would hope we can provide as much moral support if possible, and if that's lags and flags, that might be a good one to bring to our attention. And then I had just two very quick questions,
sure.
if I could. One, what is about the total amount of gallons per day that is being extracted from the Trinity River?
That's gone up. I think it's around
approximately
3,500 gallons a day.
And then the Campbell Creek slide area, was that, to the best of your knowledge, caused naturally or from man-made
It may have been logging from way back that had some residual logging roads. And it is on off the reservation, mostly on Forest Service. We did go up there and plant, I don't know, about 4,000 trees. And we have seen somewhat of a reduction in sediment, but the intense rainstorms that we get nowadays,
yeah.
It almost doesn't matter what you do. I mean, if there's open soil, it's gonna move.
Right.
But yeah, that's been going on, as I say, in 2001, and it's one of the reasons why we got out of Campbell Creek as a water source.
Yeah. Thank you.
So, did you have a question?
First of all, thank you, Mr. Miller. Because I've been heavily involved in the Russian River, and some of the things are very similar to the Russian River in terms of residences close to water bodies. Your table, and you don't need to refer to it, but it has rather specific numbers of being within a zone. Have you checked these against any permitting authority for a septic tank? Because one of the things we found on the Russian River is that there's a lot of unpermitted stuff that the county doesn't even know is there. You're doing GIS, but and we can identify buildings, but when you go look, you can't figure it out. There's no permit that's there, and I'm wondering how that works with your system.
That's, like I said, that's kind of where I'm at investigating that. I'm going to be interacting more with the county on that. They don't seem to have a database like we have, and so they haven't really had any issue with the numbers that I had, and I told them their estimates, and I try to use a very fair way of determining whether or not there's whether there's two dots or one dot, so to speak, you know, if it's a barn or outbuilding, if I look, and I can get around and drive around and actually ground truth a little bit, but whether or not something's been put in and they don't know about it is possible. From talking to some of the people who install septic systems around here, like even in Dick Rowland, who's been doing it for 40 years, you know, the closer you get to the river, you have less soil and you have more permeable material underneath. So, you know, the more development that starts happening close to the river, you're going to be risking a lot more fecal contamination going in because you have less treatment. And that I think is one of the things that we need to look at in the future is how much more development that close to the river is going to be permitted or planned, where maybe agriculture, some kind of agriculture might be a better use of that land. I'd like to see everything organic along the Trinity. It'd be great, but
Good luck. Thank you.
Any other board member questions?
Thanks,
Curtis. Hey, Curtis, as you get information, my request would be sure and just go through your channels through staff, and then staff would bring it to our attention. It's very helpful to have work be done like this under a data quality plan that's validated as well. Yeah. It validates the data, it validates some of your work. I think you're doing very good work out there that feeds the information set about management.
This will be the second year of testing under a quality assured plan, and next will be the third year, and then that's going to be the complete of the assessment, just a minimum of three, so to speak, so you can get kind of a medium, high, and average value.
Well, come back around and see us when, if not before then, you know, we'll have you back.
Sure.
Appreciate it very much. All right, Deborah, I'm back in step now. You're up, and I apologize for the misstep.
Thank you. My name is Deborah Bruce Hostler. These are my personal comments. I want to thank you for coming here, and I really want to thank Curtis for your presentation and your work. My husband is a Hoopa tribal member, so I feel a really deep commitment to the Trinity River. My comments today do tag on to some of what Curtis addressed, since I live on the Klamath River, I'm going to be talking about what I live with. I live in Orleans in the Penominic Ceremonial District in Karuk Territory in eastern Humboldt County. In the past 9 years, living next to Perch Creek, which is a tributary to the Mid-Klamath, that is an essential cold water refugia for salmon, I have seen overwhelming land use and water use changes to our small neighborhood, from increasing conversions to marijuana cultivation on private property within the state's 215 medical marijuana protection, but clearly abusive to the intent of that legislation and clearly abusive to a sensitive watershed. Am I okay with the microphone?
You're doing just fine.
Many of these changes are individually relatively small scale, but the cumulative impacts are extreme. I participated in the county's efforts to write policies to regulate against the negative environmental health and social impacts, but these efforts have been stalled with some kind of reasoning that the federal prohibition prevents local governments from regulating. I see paralysis and fear and maybe even hypocrisy and conflict of interest on the part of some officials and many watershed activists to rock the boat. Yet from conversations with other concerned citizens here and elsewhere in the state, it's clear that we are beyond the saturation point in terms of the damaging sprawl of uncontrolled marijuana cultivation, with impacts to water and air quality, water resources, impacts to fish and wildlife, and to human adults and children. And many people are expressing frustration, stress, and grief at the damage we see. Appeals to various government entities become a conversation around one jurisdiction or another, with no effective action to create or enforce policies to protect California's small and large watersheds. Policies that should be collaborative rather than counterproductive between local, state, federal, and tribal governments. In our area, we have seen recent ownership changes where parcels of private property are bought up for the sole purpose of marijuana cultivation. Right where we live, we see recent very large inputs of fertilizers that will impact sensitive creeks, recent very large deliveries of non-native soil. I ask whatever happened to the sudden oak death quarantine. With use of heavy equipment, removal of riparian vegetation, water diversions, lack of water conservation, impairments to unpaved roads that will deliver silt and pollutants to the creeks in the next heavy rains. Cumulative water diversions from the creek shed have led to a loss of riparian habitat as well as impacts to water availability for firefighting. The question I keep asking is, how much of these cumulative impacts can each creek shed tolerate before it fails to provide good habitat with adequately hydrated natural vegetation on the hillsides that can resist wildfire and abundant, cold, clean water for fish and wildlife? The term summer thermal refugia for salmon describes the conditions at the mouth and upstream on a creek that make it possible for the fish to survive by avoiding lethal conditions in summer in an overheated, polluted river, such as the Klamath. This must have something to do with water resources and water quality. some of us endanger our own safety in speaking out about this situation. The Water Resources Control Board, Water Quality Control Board, must help enforce policies and protections, create new policies and protections, whatever it takes to stop the violation of California's watersheds. And I have longer comments that I'll turn in. This was a synopsis.
Appreciate it, Deborah.
Thank you.
Any questions, comments? Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
I just have one, Mr. Chairman. I think it might be good to refer to legal counsel to come back with an opinion to the board on our authority to regulate an illegal activity. I mean, if we did require permits, is that legally possible as a mechanism either way? And I think that would both help inform the board's decision making and perhaps the state legislature and other authorities on what responsibilities we reasonably can have. It's a very complex issue, obviously, where it's not illegal enough where the sanction is working, and it's not legal enough in some ways to exercise responsibilities to regulate it civilly. And it would be nice to have a legal opinion on what are our options.
Council, can you please dive into that question for us and get back within some reasonable time period? I understand that and again, I think there's a distinction between 215 marijuana grows and illicit as far as maybe how approach an authority, but that I agree with Board Member Corbett about it is a complex issue. It is fraught with peril potentially, and at the same time, we do have authority out there, and how do we use that authority?
Yes, I think a legal memo makes sense, and I will say we are including medicinal marijuana in the ag program and have been talking about that, but and then, of course, we have authority over discharges of waste, and
yes,
that's regardless of whether that's illegal discharges. Often they are.
Yes, we do.
The problem is the mechanism to get after it, and it is dangerous. And so I think a memo is a good idea, so I'll try to draft one up for you guys.
Okay. And take your time, Council, because I realize it is a complex issue.
Okay. In the dance of public forum, we're going to cut in here. I understand that we have a recognition of somebody that's very special to us that has a meeting at 11 o'clock. So with no further ado, then, I'm going to put a pause on public forum for one moment. Mr. Bill Massey has a presentation.
It was her fault, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Yes.
Darn Heidi. Darn Heidi.
Every time.
What? Did you get him chocolate?
Yeah, he's got chocolate and
coffee,
so he should be fine.
Life is good, right?
Thank you, by the way, for reassembling. Just as a reminder, there's a bathroom across the way over here, and I believe there's one outside, because trying to get through that door over there is going to cause a backup on the...
no pun intended.
Build. Okay. All right, so we continue. I have several other... public forum cards with Mr. Matt Green.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, my name is Matt Green, registered professional forester, and also president of the California Licensed Foresters Association. And just want to take a couple seconds of your time and asked this board, you asked your staff a question about a year and a half ago, and I haven't heard that question answered yet. And that question was, how many of your staff are qualified to sit for the RPF exam?
Forgive me, I don't remember when the question was brought to us. I know you and I had some conversations about it. I don't think that we have any staff that are currently qualified to sit for that exam.
Okay. And the reason being is that you currently have a job posting for the head of the timber division, and the qualifications don't list an RPF as one of the qualifications. That position oversees, as you well know, the staff that goes out and does timber harvest reviews, sets forest policies, and basically has the same equivalency as Forester 3 for CAL FIRE. That's a pretty important position to not have an RPF exam, or RPF license. And I would really like to read something from the Professional Foresters Law about what it means to be a forester. and you can tell me whether or not, you know, that job or your posting needs an RPF license or not. Professional forester means a person who, by reason of his or her knowledge of nature sciences, mathematics, and the principles of forestry acquired by forest education and experience, performs services including but not limited to consultation, investigation, evaluation, planning, or responsible supervision of forest activities when those professional services require the application of forest principles and techniques. Further, and then a little bit further down, it actually asks what the definition of forestry is. Forestry, as used in this article, refers to the science and practice of managing forested landscapes and the treatment of forest cover in general, including, among other things, the application of science, scientific knowledge and forest principles in the fields of fuels management and forest protection, timber growing and utilization, forest inventories, forest economics, forest valuation, and finance, and the evaluation of mitigations and impacts from forest activities on watersheds and scenic values. Sounds to me like that position really needs to be considered to have a license. I have a simple solution. I know that you currently have it only open to environmental planning, I believe lists 2 and 3. The state also has lists 2 and 3. Cal Fire maintains a list just similar to yours. Consider opening that job position to those people as well, and even more so, I'd like to see it as an open listing for all RPFs. Thank you for your time. If you have any questions, I'm here to discuss it.
Mr.
I'd like to submit this letter.
Please do.
Thank you.
Just first of all, thank you, Matt, for your comments, and I did receive the letter, actually a different letter, from Matt Diaz from the California Foresters Licensing Board, as I believe his executive officer, with a similar request. Received that letter via email yesterday. Appreciate that. Certainly agree that having a registered professional forester on our staff would be a great addition. I don't think that it's necessarily a required minimum requirement for our environmental program manager position for our head of our timber division and non-point source division, but I agree with you strongly that it would be a desired qualification and would welcome applicants with that qualification very much.
Is it a reopening listing to change the qualified people that are going to apply for the list?
Hey, Matt, can you get on a mic, please?
I'm sorry. Would you consider rechanging the listing so that it's open to other people?
So those type of decisions are at the state board and the personnel department. Okay. We can certainly consult with them about it.
Thanks. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Matt. Appreciate it. I have one last speaker card for public forum, which is Mr. Daniel Meyer.
Good morning, members of the board, chairman. My name is Daniel Myers. I'm representing the Sierra Club and Friends of the Navarro Watershed. I provided a handout. I don't know if you have it. It's this.
We did get
you
it.
You have
Daniel.
That.
Yeah,
right, thanks.
Sediment work plan.
I would like to offer brief comments relating to the current plans to draft action plans and basin plan amendments for the new temperature policy. I wanted each of the board members to have this document. It's an old one. It's material for the discussions that will take place in the coming months on the temperature policy. It states on the cover it's the work plan to control excess sediment, fulfilling requirements of the sediment TMDL implementation policy, resolution 2004-0087. It ties into our current work on temperature implementation, as our settlement agreement states that the temperature implementation policy is to be modeled on the sediment TMDL implementation policy. And the temperature policy you have recently adopted State Senate's resolution, staff should continue to implement the sediment policy as a means of addressing elevated water temperature associated with excess sediment discharges. Sediment impairment equals temperature impairment. That's why we're looking at it together in this plan. Some of you will not have had experience with this document. If you leaf through it, you will find all regional North Coast watersheds with specific watershed issues and specific corrective actions. It was developed over 3 years, is highly detailed and complete. It is, in effect, a TMDL action plan that has never been given its intended regulatory effect. As you proceed to develop basin plan amendments for temperature, this work product must be included in that process. We have agreed that the Eel, Navarro, and Mattole are to be watershed-based, and we would expect that specific remediation elements described would be covered and addressed in that basin plan effort. Our concern is for the balance of the rivers, which are also covered under the policy. Where the work plan has identified the causes and sediment impairment for each of the watersheds and defined the solutions, that work product must be considered. We have limped along with most of our rivers listed on or before the 1998 303D listing, with many TMDLs projected not to be completed before 2019. The reason for this failure is identified in the work plan at page 218. Showing the need for resources that are far beyond our current staffing levels. The issue of inadequate resources does not redefine your legal obligations. I believe it works the other way around and is the rationale for our settlement. We have the opportunity to bring this excellent work plan to life. I believe that all relevant actions listed in the work plan should be updated and incorporated into the temperature action plan and basin plan amendment. The 2007 work plan can be amended, it can be revised, but it cannot be ignored. Thank you. I would just add one comment. I'd like to thank the board for the appointment of Matt St. John. I think it was an excellent choice, and I look forward to working with him in the future on these projects. Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel. Any comments or questions for Daniel Meyer? Thank you, Daniel. I have no other speaker cards for public forum. I did express in the beginning that we started a little off the beaten track over here and a little late. Was there any other public forum issues seen?